I teach writing, and it was just like, no, this won't do. I'm reading this guy, and it's like, no, something is not working. And so I asked him, because I was nice enough about it. You know, I said, Mr. Cho, I don't think I'm your teacher for you. I can help you get into another class if you'd like, or, you know, tell me what you would like to do, and we'll see if we can work on it. He said, I don't want another class. And I said, well, Mr. Cho, I don't think I've been making myself clear, because I said, I will not teach you. You will leave my class. Now, we can work this out any number of other ways, but I teach on Tuesday and Thursday. I taught on Tuesday and Thursday. I said, this is Tuesday. On Thursday, one of us will not be in this class. And he said to me, well, what you going to do? I said, Mr. Cho, I didn't have a job when I came to Virginia Tech, and I'll walk out and not have a job. But you and I, and we're in my classroom. I mean, I don't have private conversation with students. And he said, oh, you'll never quit. And I said, Mr. Cho, you don't know me, but I know you. And this is what's going to happen on Thursday. One of us will not be here. And I dismissed the class. And I went to my department head, and I said, I've got a student. And I told her about it. I said, somebody's got to go. And she said, oh, I don't think you understand him. And I said, no, I don't think you understand that I am not going to be in space with this person. Now, on Thursday, either you have gotten him out of my class, or Thursday by noon, there will be my resignation under your door. Now, you may not believe it. He didn't believe it. But I do. I know I will be gone. So it's on you.
And when it happened, what did you think?
When I heard about it, I was flying in. I was someplace else. I don't remember where. And I was flying in. So it was a Monday, and that I can tell you. And so I know he wasn't looking for me, because I'm never on campus on Monday. It wasn't personal. And they said, oh, my God, the plane was coming in. And one of the students on the plane said, oh, my God, 21 people have been killed at Virginia Tech. And all of us on the plane said, oh, you must have that wrong. It must be one or two, which was bad enough, but that's the way we looked. It must be one or two. But by the time we actually got landed, it was, the numbers were going up. So I went on home. And, of course, by then, you know, the news is on, and you knew. But I knew as I'm driving, I said, oh, this is Mr. Cho. I wish I had taken it up further. I just knew he couldn't come in my class or my office and that. And if I had taken it maybe to the provost, but I doubt that they would have kicked him out of school or anything. And it breaks my heart, because several of the students I knew, and one of my very favorite students, I always wanted to tell his mother, which I did. And I knew, his name is Matt. And I knew that Matty got shot in the chest, because he would never run. And it still makes me incredibly sad. And I just don't know what I could have done. And I was sorry I couldn't do more, but I got a call from the president's office, and Sandy Smith, who was his assistant, said, well, Nikki, we need you to close convocation. I didn't know we were having a convocation. And we waited, the president, George W. Bush, that Bush was there. And so I said yes, and I was trying to think of what to do. And I realized that what we needed at that point was a definition, and I'm big on definitions. We are Virginia Tech, not this. And I was amazed that your queen had, in fact, watched it. I wasn't even thinking about the queen. I was thinking about the 10,000 kids in front of me. And when she came to the United States, she asked to meet me, and I went over.
What did she say?
Hello. The same thing I did. I said, ma'am, how are you? She said, it was a lovely point. And it was one of those. And I just thought it was really nice, because I had no idea that the queen, you're already sad because you've lost people. And that's it. It still makes me sad. I every time I think about Maddie, it just makes me really sad. I know that there were 32 other people, but you know, you only cry for what you know. And I had no concept that the queen might be sitting watching me read a poem had no idea, and I'm glad I didn't, because it would have made me nervous.
I mean, that's the extraordinary thing about poems, isn't it? I mean, they can touch people
yeah,
in different worlds, effectively.
Yeah, yeah. But if I was going into space, which I really wish I was healthy and young, I'd do that. I would definitely take an anthology. I might put together, I should do that probably, put together an anthology, you know, space poems. Because you can read poetry over and over again, and every time you read it, you're getting something else out of it, and it's helping you get, sometimes you laugh, sometimes you, I hadn't thought about it that way. But every time you read the same poem, you get something else out of it. And that's what's so wonderful about it. And so if I was young and healthy, which I am not and am not, and sitting on a rocket ship, fooling around in the galaxy, and some life form comes to the window, knock, knock, and I'd say, hello, because everybody knows a smile is universal. So I'd smile, and it would smile, and I'd say, come in, because obviously it knows more about how to get around than I do. And it would come in, and I'm a black woman, so I would do that thing that black women do. Are you hungry, baby? Because black women, you run into black women, I don't care where you run into, it's first thing we do is feed you. And so this life form would sit there. Maybe I'd make some, well, grits are really universal, and I make good grits. And so then we talk, and I'd say, this is a poem. I wrote it when I was, you know, 50 years old, and hand him the book. And I would smile. And that's what we would talk to. Or I would sing a song. Depends on, you know, what we... Because we sing, black women sing too.
Before we go, I wanted to just briefly ask you about one other thing you mentioned, which was perhaps a result of you smoking, which was that you had cancer, you had lung cancer.
Oh, yeah.
And you survived it, and they took out a lung.
Yeah, I don't know if I've survived it. Honestly, and
well, it was a long time ago, wasn't it?
I'm living with it. Yeah, it was 13 years ago. And I always say it, and it's true, and I am going to, as we all will, die one day, but I don't want anyone to say she battled cancer, because cancer and I never battled. I always, when I wake up in the morning, you know, it's good morning, cancer, how you feeling today? You know, you want to go back to sleep, sweetheart, and I'm going to go to work. You know, I've never battled cancer, because it's no point in ever fighting a fight you can't win.
So do you think of yourself as living with it?
Oh, of course.
It's, now?
Yeah, right yeah. Now it's my friend, and I'm happy, and it's happy, and it likes champagne, because I do have a glass. I'm going to have a procedure when I go back home, and that's what the hospital just called. And, you know, they ask all these questions of what pills are you taking. I take so many pills. But the one thing is, do you drink alcohol? The answer is yes, of course. And my doctor won't let me drink red wine, so I drink champagne.
Finally, if you could change the world in any way, how would you change it?
I don't think I would change the world. I think what I don't ever want to happen, and that I do fight, I don't want the world to change me. I wrote a poem, Quilting the Black Eyed Pea, We're Going to Mars. We're going to Mars for the same reason Marco Polo rocketed to China, for the same reason Columbus trimmed his sails on a dream of spices, for the very same reason Shackleton was enchanted with penguins, for the reason we fall in love. It's the only adventure. We're going to Mars because Perry couldn't go to the North Pole without Matthew Henson, because Chicago couldn't be a city without Jean-Baptiste de Saville, because George Washington Carver and his peanut were the right partners for Booker T. It's a life-seeking thing. We're going to Mars because whatever is wrong with us will not get right with us. So we journey forth carrying the same baggage, but every now and then leaving one little bitty thing behind. Maybe drop torturing hunchbacks here. Maybe drop lynching Billy Budd there. Maybe not whipping Uncle Tom to death. Maybe resisting global war. One day looking for prejudice to slip. One day looking for hatred to tumble by the wayside. One day maybe the whole community will no longer be vested in who sleeps with whom. Maybe one day the Jewish community will be at rest, the Christian community will be content, the Muslim community will be at peace, and all the rest of us will get great meals on holy days and learn new songs and sing in harmony. We're going to Mars because it gives us a reason to change. If Mars came here, it would be ugly. Nations would band together to hunt down and kill Martians. And being the stupid, undeserving life forms that we are, we would also hunt down and kill what would be termed Martian sympathizers. As if the fugitive slave law wasn't bad enough then, as if the so-called war on terrorism isn't pitiful now. When do we learn, and what does it take to teach us? Things cannot be what we want, when we want, as we want. Other people have ideas and inputs, and why won't they leave Rap Brown alone? The future is ours to take. We're going to Mars because we have the hardware to do it. We have the rockets and the fuel and the money and the stuff. And the only reason NASA is holding back is they don't know if what they send out will be what they get back. So let me slow this down. Mars is 1 year travel to get there, plus 1 year of living on Mars, plus 1 year to return to Earth, equals 3 years of Earthlings being in a tight space, going to an unknown place with an unsure welcome awaiting them. Tired muscles, unknown and unusual foods, harsh conditions, and no known landmarks to keep them human. Only a hope and a prayer that they will be shadowed beneath a benign hand, and there is no historical precedent for that. Except this, the trip to Mars can only be understood through Black Americans, The trip to Mars can only be understood through Black Americans. The people who were captured and enslaved immediately recognized the men who came, who chained and whipped them and herded them into ships so tightly packed there was no room to turn, no privacy to respect, no tears to fall without landing on another. We're not kind and gentle and concerned for the state of their souls, no. The men with whips and chains were understood to be killers, feared to be cannibals, known to be sexual predators. The captured knew they were in trouble in an unknown place without communicable abilities with a violent and capricious species. But they could look out and still see signs of home. They could still smell the sweetness in the air. They could see the clouds floating above the land they loved. But there reached a point when the captured could not only not look back, they had no idea which way back might be. There was nothing in the middle of the deep blue water to indicate which way home might be. And it was that moment when a decision had to be made. Do they continue forward with a resolve to see this thing through, or do they embrace the waters and find another world? In the belly of the ship, a moan was heard, and someone picked up that moan, and a song was raised, and that song would offer comfort and hope and tell the stories. When we go to Mars, it's the same thing. It's middle passage. When the rocket red glares, the astronauts will be able to see themselves pull away from Earth. As the ship goes deeper, they will see a sparkle of blue. And then one day, not only will they not see Earth, they won't know which way to look. And that's why NASA needs to call Black America. They need to ask us, how did you calm your fears? How were you able to decide you were human, even when everything said you were not? How did you find the comfort in the face of the improbable to make the world you came to your world? How was your soul able to look back and wonder? And we will tell them what to do. To successfully go to Mars and back, you will need a song. Take some Billie Holiday for the sad days and some Charlie Parker for the happy ones, but always keep at least one good spiritual for comfort. You will need a slice or two of meatloaf, and if you can manage it, you will, and if you can manage it, some fried chicken in a shoebox with a moist lemon pound cake. A bottle of beer, because no one should go that far without a beer, and maybe a six-pack so that if there is life on Mars, you can share. Popcorn for the celebration when you land while you wait on your land legs to kick in. And as you climb down the ladder from your spaceship to the Martian surface, look to your left, and there you'll see a smiling community quilting a black-eyed pea watching you descend. Thank you. I know that some of you in this room don't write and some of you do. I just want to remind all of you that the first person who reads you is you. So if you're writing, remember, you are your first reader. I had a father who was crazy. Some of you have crazy fathers, and you may understand some of it, some of you don't. I worry sometimes, and I'm not going to run over, but you know, you worry sometimes. No, you do, because men are getting to be crazy, but I promised that I wouldn't do anything political, and I'm not, but... But Gus was, we called him Gus was crazy. And I've gotten to the point now that I can understand a little bit more, maybe about some of the things that made him crazy. But he's gone and it's none of my business. My mother was happy with him. But my sister, I would never have married him, believe me. But my, mommy didn't, she was happy with him. But my sister's name is Gary, and I'm the youngest. I'm the baby in the, well, no more. My aunt died on the 19th of March, and that made me the oldest person in the family. And that's so, some of you have gone through that. I mean, all of a sudden, she died at 6:08 a.m., March 19th. So at 6:09 a.m., I became the oldest person in the family. And these are things, too, you have to adjust to. You know, you keep wondering, how am I going to handle this, and am I doing things right? But I wrote a poem for Gary, and Gary's been gone too. Mommy died on June 24th, and Gary died on August the 10th. So they went off to heaven and had a good time, and they were leaving us anyway. I wrote a poem, my sister and me. Chocolate cookies, chocolate cakes, chocolate fudge on chocolate lakes, chocolate kisses, chocolate hugs, two little chocolate girls in a chocolate rug. No one can find us, we're all alone. Two little chocolate girls running from home. Chocolate chickies, chocolate bunnies, chocolate smiles from chocolate mommies, chocolate rabbits, chocolate snakes, two little chocolate girls wide awake. What an adventure, my, what fun. My sister and me still on the run, still on the run, still on the run. My sister and me still on the run. I like it. I like it. Sometimes you write a poem just because, damn it, you want to. One of the things, I wanted to share this one. One of the things that bothers me now is, and I do not understand this, in all fairness, I don't know what Americans are afraid of. Everybody keeps running around saying things like, well, we want to be safe. From what? The craziest thing in the world is us. That's the truth. That is the truth. So I wrote a poem which I really like, because, and especially those of you who write, you cannot be afraid and you cannot be worried about who does and who doesn't like what you do, because there's always somebody's not going to like it. If nobody doesn't like it, something's wrong with it. That's the truth. It's a whore. It's a prostitute. If somebody isn't saying no, I agree that you have to say yes. But if somebody isn't not understanding it, something's wrong with it. You have made it do something. You're a whore, and you don't want to do that. You don't. I mean, think about Miles Davis. Think about Charlie Parker. Think about the people that everybody says, oh, I don't understand what they're doing. They were only a genius. If everybody understands you, you got to have an IQ of 3 or 4. That's the truth. I think fear should be a spice, something we sprinkle on our steaks just before they put them on the grill, something we mix in with our corn muffins and bake at 350 degrees for 20 minutes or until golden brown. Maybe we take fear leaves, decorate them on our apple pie right out of the oven, not before, or the leaves will burn and not nearly look so pretty. I'm thinking, if we can learn to distill fear, we have two wonderful preparations: perfumes for smell, alcohol for ingestion. Perfume carries its own scent of danger and excitement. But when we throw a little fear in, things there really begin to heat up. Ask John Edwards or Herman Cain and see if I'm not right. Fear, the scent he can't resist. We'd have to find an exercise for it. We would want everybody to be able to get their hands on it. I'll have to form a committee to find that solution. Maybe the White House has some ideas. Or, yes, the Tiger Woods Emporium. Get your fear right here. You can practice your swing, whatever that might mean, while your bottle is bagged. And if we make it drinkable, we'd probably have a little light green liquid in its own 2-ounce top. You can take your fear on the rocks or sip a bit of Coke in there to make it mighty smooth. We could get the Culinary Channel to feature fear in one of their drink-offs. Or we'd reward it, the best new barrister, with his or her very own good gold bottle of fear to be used anytime they like. I need to explain right here. It's not fear that causes problems. It's when hatred is combined with it. Fear is on its own tells you not to lend your cousin money. Don't go down that dark street, girl. Take care of yourself. Take yourself home from this party now. Fear is a warning sign. Healthy, good idea. That fish smells funny. My dog does not like this man. Fear is a good thing. It's why we want to keep it exclusive. If everybody can have fear, then we have to cut it, like drugs. It's not that cocaine kills you, it's the stuff they cut it with to make the drugs go further. You don't want pure fear, but it's that it, but you don't want to be able to cut it with hatred either. Hatred is a bad idea, which is why it's cheap and available anywhere you look. Maybe what will really work is when we all need to have a fear tree in our backyard, maybe a small fear plant growing in our apartment windowsill. When we are feeling uneasy, we pluck a few leaves and find the right place to put them. Champagne would be the number one choice, but spaghetti works too. Have a little fear at least once a week, and you can build up your resistance, like a vaccination. Then when wars and hatreds come along, you'll be able to recognize that it's just another expression of fear. No thanks, I've had my share this week. And speaking of careers, the poem that definitely made people pay attention somewhat, let me pick this up, to my career, and you can't really overthink that. I mean, he's kidding, nobody really listens to me, really. I knew some of these people, but nobody listens. If they had listened to me, none of this should be happening. Nobody listened to me. But, you know, you have to know where you are in all this. But I wrote a poem called Ego Tripping. And I really loved it because my mother's a jazz fan, and I think I know probably most crooks. I know quite a few, and quite a few murderers. And well, somebody got to know them, but that's true. But when I did my third book, it was called Black Judgment. And I went to see a man called Harold Logan. Most of you probably don't know Harold Logan, but you do know Capone. You do know the Godfather. You know all of that. Well, you didn't see the black people in that, but there were black people, and Harold Logan was one of them. And I went to see Mr. Logan because I wanted the club. I wanted the jazz club that he had. It's called Birdland. And so I thought, well, all he can say is no. So I went down to see him, and Mr. Logan, how are you? I'm Nikki Giovanni. I write poetry. So, you know, Logan is looking at me like, Ann. I said, I'd like to have your club, because in New York, the clubs are closed on Sunday. I said, I'd like to have Birdland on Sunday to have a poetry reading. And Logan is looking at me, and he says, and what do I get? I said, well, Mr. Logan, what do you need? You know, let's work this one out. And he said, bring me 100 people, and you can have it for free. 99 people, and you'll owe me $500. I said, it works for me. Because, you know, you wanted your mother to be proud of you, and I thought, hell, I can get anybody can get 100 people to do any damn thing. That's the truth. You stand on a corner, you can get 100 people to do something. I mean, and so I started doing that. And that Sunday that we were having it, we're going to have a reading, that Sunday, Birdland is here. And the New York Times is there, for those of you who know New York. So the New York Times actually is looking down, and what they started to see about 3 o'clock is people coming, and people coming, and people coming. And it was a mixed group, but it's mostly a lot of black people. So what they were concerned about, speaking of fear, is what are all of these black people, and I'm sure they had another word for that, doing... doing there? What are they doing? And so they sent a reporter down, and the reporter said to the people, because we're turning the corner, what are you doing there? And the people said, Black Judgment is coming. So you can see how that's going to go, right? And the reporter came out and said, I'm looking for Nick Giovanni. And I was standing there and said, I'm Nikki Giovanni. No, where is he? I'm looking for Nick Giovanni. I just thought either he'll learn or he won't. Didn't matter to me. But we had the reading. It was really nice. My mother was very proud. And one of the things that I was excited, of course, about was a couple of the poems, and they had some good poems. And what we got was the second, for those of you who read the New York Times, we got the second news front. And they put, for the first time, a poem, and they put this poem, and I wanted to share it with you. I was born in the Congo. I walked to the Fertile Crescent and built a Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine, perfect light. I'm bad. I sat on the throne drinking nectar with Allah. I got hot and sent an ice age to Europe to cool my thirst. My oldest daughter is Nefertiti. The tears from my birth pains created the Nile. I am a beautiful woman. I gazed on the forest and burned out the Sahara Desert. With a packet of goat's meat and a change of clothes, I crossed it in 2 hours. I'm a gazelle. So swift, you can't catch me. For a birthday present when he was 3, I gave my son Hannibal an elephant. He gave me Rome for Mother's Day. My strength flows ever on. My son Noah built Newark, and I stood proudly at the helm as we sailed on a soft summer day. I turned myself into myself and was Jesus. Men intoned my loving name. All praises, I am the one who would save. I sowed diamonds in my backyard. My bowels deliver uranium. The filings from my fingernails are semi-precious jewels. On a trip north, I caught a cold and blew my nose, giving oil to the Arab world. I am so hip, even my errors are correct. I sailed west to reach east and had to round off the earth as I went. The hair from my head thinned, and gold was laid across 3 continents. I am so perfect, so divine, so ethereal, so surreal. I cannot be comprehended except by my permission. I mean, I can fly like a bird in the sky.
Nikki Giovanni, a fierce and lyrical voice whose work illuminated love, liberation, and the unyielding power of self-expression, has died. Tributes are now pouring in from across the country as admirers and friends mourn the passing of a literary legend. Writer, activist, and public intellectual Nikki Giovanni was an unmissable and unmistakable presence in American culture for more than 50 years.
I'm not ashamed of our history because I know there is more to come.
Her poetry and prose, published in more than 2 dozen volumes, grappled with race, sex, gender, and politics. And her commitment to fighting injustice inspired generations of Americans from all walks of life.
You cannot be afraid, and you cannot be worried about who does and who doesn't like what you do, because there's always somebody's not going to like it. If nobody doesn't like it, something's wrong with it.
Born Yolanda Cornelia Giovanni Jr. in 1943, Giovanni grew up in Cincinnati. At 15, she fled a turbulent family life and a father who was abusive to her mother.
I shouldn't say this on the radio, I guess, but it was clear that either I was going to kill him or I had to move. And so I decided to move.
If I dreamed natural dreams,
by the late 1960s, she had again moved to the Northeast, publishing militant, artful poetry that quickly made her a leading figure of the Black Arts Movement, and a fiery feminist counterpoint to the machismo she found in certain pockets of the Civil Rights Movement. In 1971, in a now iconic interview with James Baldwin, Giovanni, then just 28 years old, spoke to the problems she saw in the way some Black women were treated in relationships.
Why are you going to be truthful with me when you lie to everybody else? You lied when you smiled at that cracker down the job, right? Lie to me, smile. Treat me the same way you would treat him.
I can't treat you the way I treat him.
You must. Because I've caught the frowns and the anger. He's happy with you. Of course he doesn't know you're unhappy. You grin at him all day long. You come home and I catch hell. Because I love you, I get least of you. I get the very minimum. And I'm saying, you know, fake it with me. Is that too much of the Black woman to ask of the Black man? For 10 years so that we can get a child on his feet that says, yeah, father smiled at mother. He talked to me about school today.
By 30, she was a genuine literary star, selling out Lincoln Center.
1 ounce of truth benefits like a ripple on a pond.
Over the next decades, she published frequently and toured widely, often reading her poetry against the backdrop of gospel music.
He looked at his dusty cracked boots to say, sister, my time is getting near.
Giovanni spent 35 years as a professor of English at Virginia Tech. The day after a shooting there that killed 32 people back in 2007, the community turned to her for solace amid the tragedy.
No one deserves a tragedy. We are Virginia Tech. The Hokie Nation embraces our own and reaches out with open heart and hands to those who offer their hearts and minds. We are strong and brave and innocent and unafraid.
We are better than we think and not quite what we want to be.
She reminded us all to always be bold, to always speak your mind, to always lift your voice, and no matter who's watching or who's in the room, to be unafraid, to be unashamed.
Poet Kwame Alexander was a friend who had studied under Giovanni at Virginia Tech.
When I think of Black liberation and Black power and all these things that Nikki wrote about so eloquently, is I like to think of this thing I call matter-of-fact Black. The thing I think I learned from her, and that we have to remember our own humanity and not by be defined by other people. And we got to remind America and the world of our humanity as well.
Among a lifetime of accolades, she won an American Book Award and was a 7-time recipient of the NAACP Image Award. And over a career that spanned more than half a century, she remained uncompromisingly herself.
What I know is that I will not let the world change me. I think that whatever it is that I have to give, I have some truths to give. I have, there's some laughter. I'm a Black woman, and Black women, despite all of it, we still find a way to laugh.
Giovanni is said to have continued working until her final days. Her final book of poetry, titled The Last Book, is set to be released next year. Nikki Giovanni died of complications from cancer. She was 81 years old.
Well, I think anybody who reads encountered Baldwin when they were, I did when I was a teenager, because he's been writing for quite some time. I was born in 43, so I've been going to libraries all of my life. And Jimmy, he was Mr. Baldwin to me at that particular time, was one of the first or one of the earlier Black writers writing essays. So, you know, you've been reading Baldwin because, again, you can read him and reread. And I think that that's probably a good mark for any writer, to be reread. But I think when my generation, because the Baldwin generation, 20 years older than we are, I think what we saw from them was you can tell the truth. So when I started coming up with my career, I was owed a favor by PBS Broadcasting, and they asked, the producer of the show, Soul, asked me what did I want, and I said if I could do anything, I would like to meet James Baldwin. And he said, I know Jimmy, I'll call him. And much to my surprise, he said, well, I'd love to talk to Nikki, but I don't have time to come to the States. Would she mind coming to London? I said, I'll walk to London to talk to James Baldwin. And we came to London, which is why the film, it's a documentary, and why it is, I think, so good, if I may, is that the British look differently at filming. And both Jimmy and I talk with our hands. The Americans would never have photographed our hands in the same way. So it was just really great being able to do this film with him. Describing Jimmy, he was a very gentle person, so he was a great storyteller. And I would describe him, one, as a great storyteller. And actually, when you look at Jimmy's face, he's a good-looking man. And it's kind of funny because at first you look at me and think, oh, you know, this is not Harry Belafonte, you know, because Harry was sexy. And I don't think that Jimmy was sexy, but he was a good-looking man that somehow his presence always made you feel comfortable, that you didn't feel that you were in any danger, if I can use that term. Mostly with Jimmy, because he's a great storyteller, what you did was you sat and you listened. And again, those were, for lack of a better word, the big kids. I'm a Southerner, and so I grew up with kids could be seen but not heard. And so when you're sitting at the table and James Baldwin's there and Nina Simone is there, or sometimes, you know, King would come in or whatever, because they knew everybody and everybody respected them. We're just the kids. And so the intelligent thing to do was to sit and listen, because you had nothing to add. If you thought something, then you went home and wrote a poem about it. But you had nothing to add to that conversation. It's so hard with Jimmy to say favorite, but I have read and reread Notes of a Native Son. And I think that, again, every time you read it, he wrote almost poetically. And so every time you read it, you're getting something else out of it. But one of my favorite lines, if I could say it that way, and it's not a happy line, but when the 13th Amendment was celebrating its 100th anniversary, I don't know if you know, but the 13th Amendment was the one that freed slaves. And he said, well, you're celebrating 100 years too soon. And I thought, yeah, only Jimmy could nail it like that, because we are still fighting to celebrate the freedom of not just the people of color, but of all people, of all genders, and for all reasons. So I thought that he really nailed it. I'd love to see a flag, you know, someplace there. You celebrated a little too early, you know. If I was introducing another life form from another galaxy, and they said, well, I've heard of this James Baldwin, what should I read? I would say, well, read Notes of a Native Son, because it not only tells you about being Black American, it tells you a lot about America, and it tells you about hope. But also, reading James Baldwin tells you something about genius, because he was a great writer. And that I used to laugh about, because we poets are always laughing at the novelists, but he was more than a novelist. And we'd always say, well, if it wasn't for poetry, you people couldn't write. But he was a poetic writer, but he told the truth, and he never backed off of it. So that's what I would always suggest. I think that's a good start.
That was Reflections on James Baldwin from Nikki Giovanni, taking it back there a few years ago.
When I was a little girl in Indianapolis, sitting on doctor's porches with post-dawn pre-debs, wondering would my aunt drag me to church Sunday, I was meaningless, and I wondered if life would give me a chance to mean. I found a new life in the withdrawal from all things not like my image. When I was a teenager, I used to sit on front porch steps conversing the gym teacher's son with embryonic eyes about the essential essence of the universe, recognizing the basic powerlessness of me. But then I went to college, where I learned that just because everything I was unreal, I could be real, and not just real through withdrawal into emotional crosshairs or colored bourgeois intellectual pretensions, but from involvement with things approaching reality, I could possibly have a life. So catatonic emotions and time-wasting sex games were replaced with functioning commitments to logic and necessity, and the gray area was slowly darkened into a black thing. For a while, progress was made, along with a certain degree of happiness, because I wrote a book and found a love and organized a theater and even gave some lessons, some lectures on black history, and began to believe all good people could get together and win without bloodshed. Then Hammarskjöld was killed, and Lumumba was killed, and Diem was killed, and Kennedy was killed, and Malcolm was killed, and Evers was killed, and Swerner, Cheney, and Goodman were killed, and Luizio was killed, and Stokely fled the country, and Leroy was arrested, and Rapp was arrested, and Pollard, Thompson, and Cooper were killed, and King was killed, and Kennedy was killed. And sometimes I wonder why I didn't become a debutante, sitting on doctor's porches, going to church all the time, wondering, is my eye makeup on straight? Or withdrawn, discoursing on the stars and the moon, instead of a for real black person who must now feel and inflict pain. Pintar, si pintas con amor, porque desprecias su color, si sabes que quiere Dios pintar de santos de alcoba.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue here on WRCT Pittsburgh. On May 7th of 2024, I had the privilege of interviewing bassist Ron Carter, right around the time he turned 87 years old. And before I share the conversation we had, let's play a number from his catalog. This is from a 2006 record where he collaborated with guitarist Bill Frisell and drummer Paul Motion. And it's a trio version of a song that Ron Carter wrote with Miles Davis called 81. What a privilege it is to have Ron Carter on the phone with us here on Forbes Avenue. And what you just heard was Ron Carter, Bill Frisell, and Paul Motion playing 81. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Carter.
Good morning to you and yours.
I think that track is really interesting because it's something you co-wrote with Miles Davis, but it comes out totally different in a trio format with Bill Frisell and Paul Motion.
You know, I miss Paul. Paul was a wonderful drummer. He knew melodies, he knew form, he knew dynamics, he knew how to listen. And boy, drum world misses a wonderful influence on them as he's left the scene. It's always fun to play Bill. It's always fun to hear him. And I try to do that whenever I can to see what I missed last time working with him. a good band.
One thing that's fascinating to me about all of Bill Frisell's work and for you too is balancing that written music against the improvisation.
Well, I think two things, Mr. Gordon. We've kind of gotten used to leaving our ego at home, one, and two, bringing both ears to the gig. And if you have that combination, you find nice things to do.
You've played in large groups and led large groups and small groups. You've been in over 2,200 recording dates. What kinds of things stand out to you over the years of experience?
I'm always surprised that the calls I get that are not necessarily jazz bands or jazz-oriented gigs, after all the choices that they have, they decide that this guy, me, has the best chance of making their music do something that they hope it can do. All the good players come to New York. That's what we're all about here. And with the travel situation being what it is, it's easy to get to New York in a moment's notice. So that they have chosen me for their projects as a tribute to recorded sounds and social media and stuff like that. But one of the things I've taken away from these concert projects is that we all got the same notes. Mm-hmm. We just find different orders for them. And I try to find them as quickly as I can for the various projects. It's fun to do that.
I get the sense that you're really adept at both leading the gang and being a supportive team member.
Well, you know, I think quietly, Richard, the band's bass player is both of those. He's always the band leader, and he always leads the charge, so to speak. You know, in any group, Richard, he's the only person, he or she, sorry, ladies, they are the only ones who play every note all the time. That means they control the tempo, they control the changes, they determine where the beat is, they determine the pitch of the band, they determine sometimes the volume of the band. He or she is the only one that does each note has this kind of effect. And I think once we understand that plural we are able to have even more fun going to work night in and night out, which is why I go to work every night. I like those challenges.
You're 87 years old, and you're still performing and still practicing.
Absolutely. Well, my birthday was May 4. I had some nice friends over to say hello, and I'm glad to see you make it this far, given the world. Well, you know, I can't get better, Richard, unless I'm practicing what I'm aiming for. My general practice plan is I go into my practice room, and I have a goal in mind. What can I learn today playing these etudes that I didn't see yesterday? If I can cover that kind of ground and make up for those kind of missteps, so to speak, I'm really ready to go to work tomorrow night because I really figured out something to do that didn't occur to me the night before.
When you're working on your etudes, I mean, they are divorced from the music you're going to play.
Yeah, but it's still the same notes, they're just in different order, man.
So it's all about getting the tools in those fingers so that when your ears hear what the other guys are doing, you know what to pull out.
I want to be all over it. Absolutely correct.
We are chatting with Mr. Ron Carter and Pittsburgh, the home of our radio station, WRCT, is a great jazz tradition. I think of musicians like Dwayne Dolphin and Roger Humphreys and George Benson and Ray Brown, Billy Storen, Eric Blakey, David Eisenzahn, and many more. What kinds of memories do you have about either collaborating with Pittsburgh musicians or coming to town to play?
One thing, I miss seeing Dwayne often. If you see him again or talk with him, give my fondest regards and tell him I miss him.
All right.
Several of my school buddies from Eastern School of Music lived in Pittsburgh. And at one of our summer breaks, I drove from Rochester to Pittsburgh to pick him up and drive back to school. We had hung out for a weekend. 1958, something like that, man. No, 58 or so. Bill Motzing, a trombone player from Pittsburgh, really played really well and wrote nice arrangements. My other view of Pittsburgh is the jazz club that they had there. What's the name of that place?
Was it the Grill?
Yes, Crawford Grill. Back in the day, they had a knowledgeable jazz crowd. They came and have a good time, but hear the music. They always wore the latest fashions. It was like been in New York, only in Pittsburgh. Loved it.
Well, there's still quite a bit of jazz being played in Pittsburgh, and there's even a church that has jazz vesper service every month. Yeah, it's really cool.
I miss Nathan Davis, too, by the way. He was one of my friends from the clinics up there for summers. He was promoting the jazz community's music in and around the city. Lovely man. I'm sorry he's left the concert.
What is different for you about playing for a live audience, whether a club or a concert, or going into a recording session?
I guess three main things. The level of sound that's necessary, no matter how good the club is and how good their system is, the studio requires less physical effort to make the sound of the instrument, in this case bass, fill the room space. Mm-hmm. Secondly, given the quality of microphones and as engineers are learning to record the instrument music better, you needn't play so hard and so forcefully, literally, mm-hmm. for the duration of the gig in the studio as you would have to do in a nightclub. And thirdly, generally speaking, you're in a smaller spectator space. Generally, only the band is at the recording studio, so there's no other views or impressions you want to leave on somebody else who's not playing vis-a-vis the audience. In the studio, you're referring to and relaying to the members of the band, the producer, perhaps, an engineer. So your focus is limited to five or six people, and it's a lot easier to control that than having your view, your emotional view, your physical view, spread out over a huge room with 2,000 fans.
Has it been your experience that it's easier for the musicians to communicate with each other in a recording session?
Depends on the gear of the studio. Sometimes they have good earphone sets. Sometimes they're prepared to not have any at all. It varies on the situation.
As an amateur bassist myself, I know how important it is to listen and to be able to hear everybody so that, as you say, you can set the pace for them, but also support them in whatever they're doing.
Well, I think a footnote to that, Richard, is that it's important for them to hear me, in this case, me, the bass player.
Right.
Each note I play, and sometimes studios are not geared for that level of bass sounds and notes available to the guys in the band. I've seen some pictures recently of a studio, when a quintet was playing in the studio, and they had everyone in the same room. And I think that's not going to be, that can't be productive for the bass player, because given the space they're living with or playing with, no one in this group, no matter how quiet they play, can hear every note he or she plays.
Right.
I kind of demand that, you know, and I know that that situation that they're in right there moment, that's not going to happen. I don't mind note to go to waste. I think it's impactful for all those reasons I mentioned earlier about each note that I played does those things, and I think that they're doing a disservice to the bass player and his musicians when they are unable to not literally hear every note he or she plays.
Sounds to me like you sort of favor the setup where the bass player is in a separate room but with a glass to see the other players.
Yes, and I don't know how much time you have, but I'll tell you exactly why I feel that way. In an open space, where the bass player is in the middle of a room with no barriers around him, stacks of glass, the bass tries to fill all the space around it. Mm-hmm. However big the space is, the bass sound fills that whole area. By the time it gets to the microphone, the sound is so diluted because it's been played, it's been ringing around in this room for all this square footage, that the sound cannot be as impactful or as startling and sounding because the sound is delayed, it's decayed, it's dying by the force of the sound. By the time the force of the sound gets to the microphone, whatever quality it is. And I think to have the bass player more isolated in the room, that's a 6x6 room, it forces the sound of the bass, all of the sound, into the microphone that's now only 2 feet away rather than 25 feet away and according to the room. No, I'm not a fan of that at all.
That makes good sense. So you always work with a microphone, or when you play live, do you sometimes work through a pickup?
All those factors are varied. Generally, I have a pickup from a David Gage in New York, a realist, that works really good for me. And the microphones, depending on where it's placed, depending on how close I am to the drums, depending on whether the piano lid is up all the way or halfway, all those sounds are feeding to my microphone. Mm-hmm. And as a bass is only one instrument times four, or whatever size the quartet is, that microphone cannot possibly isolate enough from everyone else's sounds for the bass sound to be more present in his microphone, quote unquote, his.
We are chatting with Ron Carter, and bassists out there, you're getting a lot of good tips here from Mr. Carter. As a teenager, I know that you switched from classical music to jazz, and I know that you also made a change from cello to bass, and my sense is that the jazz world is much more about can you play rather than are you from the right side of the street or the preferred race. Have you found that that's true, that the jazz community is more welcoming of more kinds of people?
That was the case back in the day. But I think if you take photographs of orchestras, classical orchestras, the big top five orchestras from 1957 to 2024, I think you will see that the proportion of minorities, people of color, the proportion of graduates from classical schools, and the proportion of them in classical orchestras is not much better in that 30 or 40 year span.
Right.
When I was coming up, it was made pretty clear to me that orchestras, while no matter how good I played, the management was not prepared to hire a person of color in those orchestras back then. And my position is, I'm not sure that much of that has changed given the photographs you found on the internet. So having discourage is a pretty strong word, but that's probably what it really was. A career in playing classical music, the jazz community welcomed me to New York to try to come to New York because all the players end up there. So there I was. I have not forsaken classical music. And if you didn't know my library, I've recorded some jazz classical songs and other. I have a nice classical music library in my home of discs and music. I'm still aware of the music, and I will try to play it whenever I get the opportunity to. Every Christmas, for example, high school orchestras and church orchestras need extra bass players to play the Handel, the Hallelujah Chorus, or they may have a Brandenburg Society that needs bass players during the course of the holidays. I'm always available to those concert groups, and I play as many as I can as my schedule allows and the availability of it. So I have not forsaken them. I still encourage the music. I can endorse anyone who wants to play that. Go ahead and get your feet wet and enjoy what it does for you. I'm the jazz player in the meantime.
That classical background, I'm sure, has influenced the way you approach practicing and the way you approach performing.
Well, I think the biggest influence for me was, Richard, was how to practice. Back then, the competition as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old was stunning. Of all the good players who were already ahead of me in background and experience, and know that I could kind of make those being the big steps so far ahead of me, not so far back, and kind of even the score, was to know what I had to learn during each practice time. So before I sat down to my cello at the time, I'd figure out what do I need to make this practice time allow me to do with more ease, or a new fingering, or better intonation, a better sound. And when my practice time was over at 2 or 3 hours, I'd stop and say, now, what did I learn this past two and a half hours, or whatever it was? Can I remember what that was and translate that to the next practice time the next day? I still had that mindset, Richard.
That's one of the many things that you'd like to share with other musicians. I mean, all these...
Absolutely.
All this knowledge and experiences, and I know you want to help us all learn from your experiences. So you've got a lot of information up at the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
Yeah, well, you know, one of my concerns, Richard, this is my concern day, I guess, is that the most books that the jazz bass player is studying are built on playing, in this case, bass horizontally and as fast and as rhythmically and clean as possible. And I certainly admire that concept. My books are different than that. I try to teach my students to play as horizontally as possible across the bass, and my exercises are based on chords. Mm-hmm. My feeling, Richard, is that once the student understands harmony and what the chords sound like and what direction the chords are headed, what's the point of this chord going from this chord to this chord, they see the result of that, they'll play the music differently because they understand the harmony behind the influence of these notes being what they are.
That's a very, very good point. And again, folks, you can find that information about the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
All right.
Now, Ron Carter, you are one of my favorite bassists. I think I told your people that you and Charlie Hayden and Slam Stewart and Dave Holland are probably my favorite bassists.
Well, great. I'm in good company.
But you have also been an integral part of some of my favorite jazz recordings, you know, the Herbie Hancock sessions with Cantaloupe Island and Maiden Voyage and so much great work with Miles. But I still love your work in the trios. And one of my absolute favorites is that old record you made, Jazz My Romance, with Kenny Barron and Herb Ellis.
But, you know, I always wanted to play with Herbie. I've known him for a very long time because I'm a Oscar Peterson fan. And, of course, Ray Brown and Ed Thigpen, he joined the band. And I said, well, my record contract list lasts two more records. I've got to get Herbie on a record, Herbie Ellis. And Kenny Barron was available at the time my schedule opened up, and I was trumping on a bit to try to track down Herbie Ellis and where he was and could he make this record with him. Well, we had such a great fun. He's just a wonderful guy. You know, wonderful sound of the rhythm he used to play. Just a killer. And I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Carter.
Rich, good to talk to you. And I'm sure I'll see you in Pittsburgh. Forget to say hello.
And we're going to let the folks hear Sweet Lorraine from that very record, Jazz My Romance.
And please enjoy Kenny Barron. What a diamond he is. Thank you. Thank you.